Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. This week, we are joined by Richard Seymour, who's the author of a new book, The Disenchanted Earth, Reflections on Eco-Socialism and Barbarism. Richard, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here.
Excellent. Just to begin with, can you tell us a little bit about your career as a writer and how you came to this ecological awakening, which you, I guess the book kind of chronicles, doesn't it?
Well, I started writing as a blogger, really. I think I had always thought I wanted to be a writer, and this seemed to be just the easiest way to do it on a regular basis and build up an audience. And I did build up a highly niche kind of audience because it was far left politics that I was hawking. But that enabled me to, you know, learn the ropes. Gradually acquire a sense of my own style, shed some bad habits. About 2006, I got contact from someone in Verso asking me if I would consider looking at doing a book on the upsurge of liberal imperialism, which was, during the Iraq War. There had been a lot of liberals and former leftists coming out for Bush, coming up for the war in Iraq, a sort of project of right-wing adventurism, you know, not even sort of middle-of-the-road democratic humanitarian interventionism, but outright chaos. So obviously, I jumped at the chance, you know, and I spent the next couple of years in libraries and doing interviews and researching as much as I could and digging into a history of about 400 years of humanitarian intervention, as it were. Not even that, of liberal justifications for empire, from Grotius and Locke, you know, justifications for slavery, racism, etc., up to the sort of high Victorian era of, John Stuart Mill, Alexis de Tocqueville, and their alternative justifications for empire. Mill's basic conception was that the peoples of the colonial world were not yet fully adults. They were not, they were of their nonage, and they would not reach a full democratic subjectivity and adulthood until they'd been schooled that way by their white colonizers. Throughout the 20th century, the Fabians and the sort of so-called liberal internationalists in the United States had a similar sort of approach. And this overtly racist international politics isn't broken until the sort of movements of decolonization. And even there, you've got a backlash by the neoconservative right, but they gradually learn to speak the language of human rights and anti-totalitarianism and universalism rather than overt defenses of colonialism, white supremacy, and so on. Although you would get some quite brutal arguments defending, for example, death squads and dictatorships because the alternative is communism, etc. 1990s, you see a rebirth of certain paternalistic arguments for empire in the idiom of humanitarian intervention. And that sort of kickstarts a whole process wherein you know, after 9/11, certain civilizational arguments that had been popular in the 19th century begin to gain real force in the popular imagination, and particularly in the imagination of intellectuals. We're in a fight to the finish, as Christopher Hitchens put it. You know, we're going to fight Islam, and Islam represents this alternative civilization. So that was the sort of thrust of my research for a few years, and that was my first book. And for a first book, it did all right. You know, like, I didn't expect it to sell amazingly, but it got respect from the kinds of people I wanted it to get respect from, and it was hated by the kinds of people I wanted to hate it as well. And from that, I started to get invitations to write the occasional article in The Guardian, etc. So that by the early 2010s, I was writing a regular-ish column for The Guardian, and, you know, churning out books. And I don't know, since 2015, I've been a founding editor of Salvage magazine, one of the editors, from a founding group of four, and that has shaped a lot of my writing, including this, obviously, particularly the emphasis that we began to develop, the consciousness we began to develop of ecology, climate change. So, you know, that's a part of my background. A large part of it is also just the politics. You know, I was a Trotskyist activist, a militant for, I don't know, 15 years, something like that. And then me and a bunch of others left the Socialist Workers' Party because there had been accusations of rape, which they had covered up. And so we found ourselves looking at a world in which the prospects for the left were quite bleak, and we no longer had this protective chassis of, you know, a small party organization that's relatively homogenous and at least appears to be efficacious in some ways. And so Salvage, the magazine that we launched, was specifically, you know, what was to be salvaged was what was salvageable from the left, you know, from the history of not just, you know, social democracy, trade unions, but specifically of communism and its failures and the ruinous experience of Stalinism, etc. What is left out of all that? What's left in the rubble? What can we rebuild with? So it's very much in the Brechtian spirit of don't look to the good old days, look to the bad new things.
And so what particularly brought you to the ecological crisis? In the book, you kind of pin it on one kind of moment, don't you? A walk in London, I think.
I think sometimes, you know, memory and experience can be misleading in that way, because I'm sure that this was something that was building for a while. But there just happened to be a day, and it was a the warmest Christmas on record, and there's been a few of those, and it was just a bit clammy. It wasn't spectacular. This wasn't, you know, a day in which there were wildfires sweeping the planet, or, you know, storms or polar perturbations, anything like that. It was odd. It felt really, really odd. It felt uncanny, but it also felt somewhat mournful, because suddenly there was this feeling that all of the stuff that, in terms of the stuff of the natural world, the material of the world, that I was used to taking for granted, that I just assumed would be there, and didn't really understand how much I valued, that a lot of that would no longer be there. Soon, nothing like I was used to would exist. Now, that can lend itself to a kind of conservative, nostalgic kind of politics, but that's not where I'm going with that. It's obviously we, you know, the world changes, climates change, but there are certain changes that are absolutely catastrophic. That's just, you know, that's in the Marxist tradition, Benjamin, you know, talking about slamming on the brakes when a train is hurtling off into catastrophe. So there was that. And I refer to it as an icicle stab of grief, because that very much felt what it was like. It was very sudden and very jarring. But as I say, we in the Salvage Collective had been talking about this, and we'd been talking about it because it was in the news, because all of a sudden, unlike in previous periods where, you know, you would occasionally see some manifestation of climate change, but the manifestations were becoming very frequent, very obvious, very vivid, you know, hottest year on record. Suddenly, we're learning that there are fires in the Arctic Circle, which, you know, there are always some fires in the Arctic Circle, but they're way worse than they've ever been. You know, the intensification of storms and so on. And when that's to happen, you start by trying to apply your traditional lenses, you know. So we were all Marxists of a particular hue, and you push it to its limits. You find how far it can go. And obviously there is a rich body of Marxist writing from Jason W. Moore, John Bellamy Foster, Andreas Malm, and so on, who write about the sort of processes of ecological destruction, but also about, the whole question of metabolism, material throughput, energetics, and so on. But obviously, certainly our inherited versions of Marxism are in a state of some crisis, because one of the objects of, you know, the Marxist strategic purview is this: you build up a material superabundance. This is how you're going to create a society in which the muck of ages, all the horrible conflicts, all the tendencies to exploit people, all the tendencies to be racist and sexist, you are going to create a society in which those things can be managed much more easily, and in which plenty is going to mitigate the tendency towards conflict, and also in which you don't have to exploit anybody to generate a huge amount of wealth. You know, the whole point about capitalism is that it's produced unbelievable amounts of wealth, in the unprecedented in the history of humanity, but in so doing, it has, massively accelerated the rate at which people are being exploited for their labor power. The idea is that you can create such plenty that actually we can now live in a relatively egalitarian, highly educated, high technology civilization. Sounds great. In its way, it was supposed to be more scientific than the kind of utopian socialists or than the anarchists like Kropotkin or Bakunin, who would look at, who would say that people were basically good and basically inclined towards mutuality and cooperation. And if you, if you just liberated the basic decency of human beings from the horrors of competition and poverty and so on, then you would bring out our innate cooperativeness and goodness. Well, I'm vulgarizing there, obviously, and I'm not doing them justice, but the point is that we were supposed to be more sophisticated than that, but it turns out that we've now come up against a kind of problem that doesn't allow us to contemplate traditional versions of red plenty. The idea that there's just going to be a superabundance of stuff in the future is at least now heavily qualified, because the stuff of the past, you know, what's the main stuff? Energy, right? Where are we going to get our energy from if not from fossil fuels? Fossil fuels basically gave capitalism a much longer lease on life than it need necessarily have had. But the whole of contemporary civilization and the whole idea of plenty and abundance that we have is based upon it. Can we transition to 100% renewable energies and also keep using as much energy and also keep consuming as much stuff? No, manifestly not. We're overfishing, overfarming. We're acidifying the oceans. We'll come back to this "we" in a second, but we are doing all this stuff. Even, for example, in a country like the United Kingdom, to transition to 100% renewables I think it would be a major, I don't think it's really possible actually, but according to FIRES, the think tank looks into this, they've worked out a way in which it would be possible according to their sort of projections, but they say very clearly, look, we're going to have about 60% of the energy then than we have now, given that the population will have grown, given that living standards are supposed to have increased, given that we're supposed to be doing better then, to subsist on 60% of the energy that we're using now, it's a bit of a challenge. Now, some of that can be achieved through greater energy efficiency. Some of it can be achieved by the fact that electricity just is more efficient than fossil fuels. So you'll need to use less. But overall, we're going to have to use less energy and consume less stuff. And given the role of agriculture in climate change alone, just one of the many crises, never mind mass extinction, we're going to have to change our diets, either severely restrict meat eating or turn to vegetarianism or veganism. I'm open-minded on all of those questions, but the point is that for the first time, we're in a position of saying, actually, we're, you know, there are a lot of people who are in poverty. There are a lot of people who aren't particularly doing well out of life. Millions of people are being exploited, etc. But the collective impact of our consumption is problematic. And even working class people are going to have to change their consumption habits quite significantly. The question is, can we work out a way in which that's done, in which is actually registered as an improvement, as a felt, you know, in increase in the quality of life? So there's all sorts of challenges that this poses. For me, there's the intellectual challenges, like trying to work it out, having never much paid much attention to scientific literature, climate literature, and so on. But also there's the emotional shift that was entailed by just looking at the state of the world and the planet specifically and thinking, what is it that one values? What am I attached to? And I found that for me, there are a number of things. I like the Arctic. I'm very fond of the idea of these polar ice caps. I don't want them to disappear. I like the idea of a blue sky, so I don't want to whiten it by pumping it full of sulfate particles in the name of geoengineering to keep out sunlight. I like the abundance of life, the web of life. I don't know if this has anything to do with E.O. Wilson's speculative idea of biophilia, you know, the idea that there's an instinct to be fascinated with, enjoy, be enthralled by life. I think maybe there's something more fundamental, which is that matter itself is enchanting, or should be. So there's the intellectual aspect, there's the emotional aspect, no doubt there's, I'm very interested in psychoanalysis, so I talk about this in terms of the unconscious and our drives, but all of that's got to be involved as well. It can't just be a question of the facts, because we know something we know about human beings is we don't just operate on the basis of the facts. There are all sorts of non-rational and irrational contributors to human behavior, and that includes you and me sitting here right now.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things I liked about the book especially is that it does open these enormous sort of vistas of, you talk about literature, there's incredible quotes in there you take from, you know, the Odyssey or Robert McFarlane, or and then you bring in scientific literature, then psychoanalysis. And one of the terms which I've sort of clung on to was this idea of the untimelick, which I guess kind of attempts to interpret the sense that deep futures, deep pasts are suddenly entangled in present moments, especially in relation to capitalism, which I suppose is your particular interest. So could you tell us a little bit about your pun on timelick?
Well, this began as a mundane reflection on the experience of being awake in the night and in those hours when, you know, sometimes you can wake up and you can be quite disoriented, you can be frightened, you feel small, and you can't tell how much time has passed. Is it a second? Is it an hour? The reality principle, as Freud referred to it, with all the temporal and physical laws of the world, appears to have momentarily disintegrated. And there's a sense that normality will never return, even though you know you will wake up in the morning and get on with it. Because this experience in the middle of the night is saturated with dream life, you know. It's saturated with everything that was going on in your head while you were asleep that you were barely aware of. And so when I talk about the untimelich, you know, this pun on Freud's concept of the unheimlich, the unhomely, the uncanny, I'm sort of talking about how the unconscious has seeped into the planet's records, a sort of telluric telltale, the Anthropocene. And in terms of the stratigraphy of sort of rock deposits, layers, and so on, it's very thin. It's barely sort of recognizable, but we're starting to appear in these deposits. And that is... what's creepy and uncanny about it is because it's not just... something alien or other. It's both familiar and other. Lacan, the French psychoanalyst, had a term for this. He called it extimate as opposed to intimate. There's something in you that is out of you, that it's the bit of the outside that sticks to the inside, or the inside that belongs to the outside. And so when you think about ecology, we know that it derives from the Greek word oikos, which has to do with place to live, home, right? In the same way that an economy has to do with a household budget. There's something horrifying about the homely. There's something about it that bears the deepest part of our anxieties, the fear of annihilation, of being chewed up, poisoned, descending into madness. You know, children often have a fear. Well, they have all sorts of fears. One of them is, for example, being sucked down the bathhole. You know, this is a common phobia. And, you know, the one can see in this the fear of being consumed by the mother, of being, eaten. Well, for Freud, the archetype of the uncanny is the maternal body and the way that in fantasy it becomes a grave. It eats you, you become a grave, much as the Earth Mother is both a birthplace and a grave. So it's the dirt to which we return. And human history has been sustained by the idea, at least, of a relatively stable accumulation of cultural knowledge, intelligence, descending from ancestors to offspring, and so on. At least that's the idea. Capitalism obviously completely disrupts and upends all that. The idea of the ancestors is felt to be somewhat embarrassing now, unless you're attached to certain, for example, indigenous cultures where it's quite common to say, we respect the ancestors, we worship the ancestors, we communicate with the ancestors. We tend to think the ancestry now is a gimmick. You know, you look up your DNA and you find out how much of your ancestry is Native American or whatever, all that sort of stuff. But so we don't really have that connection. And then there's the sort of way in which the sort of temporality of capitalism changes everything. So it's no longer, certainly it's not a sense of progress in the Enlightenment sense, you know, human progress. And it's certainly not the cyclical sense of time that's established, in traditional societies on the basis of seasons and so on. It's just the accumulation of stuff, the endless accumulation of stuff. Progress is nothing more than growth, GDP. And growth includes all sorts of stuff, not just good stuff. You know, GDP goes up if there's a burglary, you know, that kind of thing. GDP goes up sometimes if there's a war. War has the most extraordinary effects. So we're finding that as the temporality of capitalism just becomes the eternal present, more of the same, more accumulation of stuff, it also starts to turn the cyclical time of seasons rather freakish. It starts to accelerate sort of eras and epochs to the point where it's speeding so rapidly that it precipitates a crisis in the temporal order itself. You know, the fact that we could have mass extinction, a megaphase change in microphase time, the mass extinctions historically take millions of years. We're speeding it up quite dramatically. All of this is happening and it's precipitating a crisis in this temporal order itself. And we're spinning so fast, we may as well be standing still. And the Anthropocene is the name for this, not for the most advanced phase of human civilization, as if that was possible anymore, but a sudden derailing, a spin-off reality, a meltdown. And so that's the experience of the untimelike. And it's very palpable once you start to pay attention to what's happening. Another example, the death spiral in the Arctic. Human beings have never existed without polar ice caps. They're essential to the sort of climate, the global climate that enabled human beings to thrive. We are creating a sort of a rapidity of warming, which is possibly unprecedented. And we're driving the world to, basically the last IPCC report suggests possibly 3.2 degrees, maybe more. It's quite plausible we'll get to over 4 degrees. Last time the world was 3.2 degrees above pre-industrial temperatures, I think was about 15 million years ago. Sea levels were tens of meters higher than they are now. World was a very different kind of place. So creating through the logic, the grammar of capitalism, and through the incentives that it creates for us, we're creating a radically new temporality for the planet, one which may actually wipe out the human species. That's entirely possible. That's on the more catastrophic end of events, but I think it would be rather stupid not to game that scenario, not to think through how would we get there? What are we going to do about that? You know, and here it's, I think it's important to make a distinction between, on the one hand, a kind of survivalist logic, which it truly is apocalyptic, because basically survivalism just says there's no possibility to do anything. I don't believe in the collective will to change anything. The people are stupid. The masses are sheeple. I'm going to go and live in a mountain somewhere and stock up on goods and wait for it all to come crumbling down. And that's the apocalyptic mentality, truly, in some sense, relishing it, addicted to it, hooked on it, like the QAnons, you know, bring on the storm, the day of reckoning. Well, we are, what I'm talking about is certainly an attention to a form of apocalypse. You know, the apocalypse is very possible, but it'll be much more mundane and boring and difficult and dreary. And it will do the usual things in terms of it will hurt the poor first. It will hurt the racially oppressed first. It will destroy the nations of the global south first. And its effects will spread out from there. But the point of contemplating the worst possible scenarios is not to get hooked on it, not to become fixated on the image, enthralled by the image of disaster, but to mobilize intelligent constituencies capable of taking action to stop the catastrophe that we're hurtling towards.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a question on agency and sort of connect it with this untimelich term. I remember Freud writing on the uncanny says that one of our experiences of the uncanny can come about when we see somebody suffering from a seizure, and that kind of brings about the idea that they might, it's kind of like the mechanical within the biological person, and this idea that they've lost agency, I suppose. Does that kind of chime with your reading of maybe popular writings on the, you know, climate catastrophe, this idea that there's just a continuous march forward and, you know, people feel somewhat unable to do anything, or there's a loss of agency in, you know, political discourse, perhaps.
I mean, I hadn't thought of it in that way, and it sounds like a plausible and suggestive idea, but I don't think I should pretend that I have any deep thoughts about that. That just sounds like something we should leave hanging, because it might actually be quite productive.
Okay. Well, thanks. So I guess we should move forward and talk about climate sadism, which you do write about in the book. In your previous book, The Twittering Machine, you discuss social media, well, especially Twitter, I guess, right? And I wanted to ask, in climate sadism, you refer to people who own SUVs and they do so in order to you know, say, you know, to own the libs, I think you say.
There's a lot of this posturing. You remember every time Greta Thunberg would open her mouth, there would be a lot of what in the United Kingdom is colloquially known as gammon. A lot of older men, very red-faced, working themselves up into both erotic excitement and fury over her. And part of the logic of this would be, you know, well, I'm going to go and buy a sub, and then I'm going to drink Greta Thunberg's tears, you know, this kind of pathetic social media posturing. Not particular to the right, by the way. You know, you see a lot of that on the left and, you know, more generally. But this particular version of it is, so, like, you're such a carelord. You care about the environment. Well, if you care so much about the environment, I'm going to smash its face in, and I'm going to really enjoy it. Now, one of the things that Freud sort of tells us is that there, you know, the I, the self, is a bit of an illusion. You know, the ego is a fantasy. It's a fantasy of a contained, sort of coherent individual self. And that actually, when you look at people, there are different idioms for talking about this, but most people contain others. You know, so object relations theorists would say, you know, other people are represented in your psyche by a particular mental object, which you have constructed and which you valued in a particular way. Okay, well, you know, that's one way of talking about it. Lacanians would talk about it in another way. But basically, we can say that however we are made up, we are made up of our relationships to others. And so, in a sense, when we start to, let's say, engage in acts of demonstrative sadism, towards others, there's always a sense in which we are also identifying with them as the victims. There's also a sense in which we are enthralled by the kind of masochistic position. You know, the typical triangulation is you're the victimizer, and the onlooker, the passive onlooker. Well, okay, so you triangulate between these perspectives, and that's true. That's just a formula for fantasy. It's true whether you're watching porn, or whether you're watching snuff footage, or whether you're watching, you know, a cop beating or something like that. That sort of stuff is always going on. So it's worth not being too impressed by this machismo. You know, in a way, what one is doing by saying, you know, I'm going to smash the environment's face in just to see the look on your face, you idiot, is you're waging war. You're engaging in a counterattack upon your own desire. In a way, we always, you know, do that when we're talking about social and emotional pain. There's always a choice as to whether we identify with the person who is suffering and empathize with them, and therefore potentially try to engage in some sort of reparative action. Although I should be cautious and careful about this, because empathy can actually be quite horrendous. Empathy can be accompanied by unbelievable viciousness. So I don't want to pretend that if we just develop our sympathetic imagination, we can then heal one another and heal the world. No, that's not what I'm saying. But we are making a choice about how we identify and disidentify with other people. And we're always kind of doing both at the same time. So I don't. I'm saying yes. This is a short note on climate citizen, but I'm saying that there is. It's a tendency. It's a rhetorical pattern. Clearly, there's going to be. There's a lot of people who are being mobilized for the idea of mass death. We saw this in the storm in Texas. Where a lot of people were dying, either freezing to death or they were dying because they had decided to warm up their house by turning on the car, and then they were breathing in the carbon monoxide and choking themselves. People were in desperate situations because of this unprecedented storm, bringing sub-zero temperatures to a Texas, a state that usually is not suffering sub-zero temperatures. And the electricity went out and all the rest of it. Well, you saw a lot of people saying things like, there were displacements. There was an attempt to blame the left, blame the Green New Deal. It's all their fault, etc. That's why we don't have power. But there was a quite telling moment where a local mayor said he was sick of all these whiners and losers begging him for help and not realizing that actually, only the strong survive in this world. Now, that didn't quite work out as he wanted it to. He was forced to resign. But that was because he didn't sort of make a distinction. If he'd been able to, he could have said that he was, or implied that he was talking about black people, let them die, like racialize the question. That's one way in which you can get away with sort of justifying mass death. Another way we saw during the pandemic, I don't know if you remember all those Republican politicians saying, hey, look, the people of this country would rather, grandparents would rather die for the freedom of their young than go under lockdown. Basically, they're saying that, a lot of people will die to keep capitalism going, even if it means, mass illness and mass death. And Jesus Christ, America has already got over 1 million deaths as a result of this. And who knows how reliable that is, because the government did not keep reliable data for the first months of the pandemic. So we don't actually know how many people have died. So the point is that there is a general pattern wherein politicians of the right are developing, they're no longer saying, if you vote for us, we'll keep the, we'll conserve things, we'll keep things stable, we'll protect you from the bad guys, we'll keep the poor, we'll keep blacks, we'll keep gays out of your community, and we'll allow you to become rich. They're now saying a lot of people are going to have to die in order to keep anything as it was, in order to prevent some terrible catastrophe. You notice that the catastrophic imagination is very popular on the right, white genocide, death panels, the great replacement, all of this stuff. And the people who believe that stuff tend to be the ones who either commit mass shootings or engage in some other catastrophe-inducing behavior, like the storming of the Capitol. So this, with regard to climate change, there's going to be an emerging subjectivity, which is not climate denial, but affirmation. Bring it on. Warm up the planet. We're going to be fine. It's you guys that aren't going to be fine. We're going to be fine. We're going to build... This country is going to be a green zone. We're going to keep out the immigrants. And we're going to take care of ourselves, and whatever energy we need, we're going to go out there and get from the world. If we need materials for renewable energy, we're going to go out there and get it. In other words, it's a very militarized, paranoid, isolationist, in one manner of speaking, imperialist in another manner of speaking, solution. And that's you know, that's the kind of danger that we're up against. And that has much more popular appeal than you would think if you just assumed that people are, you know, rational self-maximizers pursuing enlightened self-interest or anything like that. That's manifestly not the case.
And just before we go, you said this is just your first book on the ecological crisis. So would you be able to give any hints of what kind of aspects you're looking at for the future?
I am working on another book about this. I mean, I've got some books on the go, and one of them is about climate change and mass extinction. I don't want to, because the thing is not fully formed in my mind yet, I don't want to go into too much detail, but I'm particularly interested in the problem of mass extinction. I guess our effective relationships to not just the planet, which can seem like an abstract thing, but to non-human life, and obviously the way in which that affects our politics and what happens to our social relations with other humans when our social relations with animals, non-human animals, are, let's say, exploitative, eliminationist, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I'm interested in pursuing that, and we'll write a book on it, which will probably have the characteristic blend of Marxism, psychoanalysis, literary references. I'm reaching, you know, for the top shelf in the cultural canons here to be as impressive as possible. Although actually, I mean, this is just... this is a subject, I remember Jacqueline Rose, when she was interviewed a few years ago, she said, there are many subjects you leave behind. And she'd just written a book about Palestine. She said, Palestine is one of those things you don't leave behind. It's not a subject you move on from. Well, that's also true for me of climate change. When I say this is the first book on climate change and ecology and the planet and nature writing, I can't see that I will be doing anything other than writing lots and lots of stuff about this for the foreseeable future.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much. We look forward to reading you more.
All right. Brilliant. Thanks for talking to me. I look forward to seeing this published.